And a lot of people probably only saw him as an older man. And in this one, it's that guy, and he's young.
Yep.
I love that. And also, there's a Bert Convy sighting. Bert Convy, the game show host from the 70s. Bert Convy's in this movie.
No, I don't want to date you, but I'll be nude alone with you when all of your sculpture is about murder. Absolutely, why not?
The visuals were absolutely horrific, especially as it goes on. It gets scarier and scarier and scarier, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to have nightmares about it for the rest of my life just from how it looked alone.
Welcome to a podcast that we hope will be suitable for framing. See what I did there? It's the Fright Club podcast, and she is Hope Madden.
He's George Wolf.
And we're from madwolf.com. And yeah, we're going to talk about, with a special guest, we're going to talk about a subject that another one of these where we can't believe we haven't done it before.
Yes, because these are fun movies.
They are fun movies, and it's a great topic. I love art. Anyway, I was close to minoring in art, but there was much architecture. Like, I just want to talk about paintings. Can we do that? They didn't want to do that. So we're talking about art, and we've got a lot of great movies and a great special guest. But first of all, we want to say thank you to the great crowd. We always say that.
We do.
But it was a great crowd, and they were psyched up to see the 45th anniversary 4K restoration. A beautiful print, by the way, of Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, that was super cool. We want to thank Chris Hamill at the Gateway Film Center for acquiring that beautiful print and letting us show it at Fright Club last month. We had a giant turnout, and among them, our first legacy Fright Clubber, Avery.
Yeah, Avery Dean.
Avery Dean, whose dad, John Dean, is Fright Clubber number one. The very first he went to, he started at the first Fright Club when I think seven people showed up, and he's been to.
And she and his wife, Heather, a longtime co-worker of mine, showed up for the first time ever.
That's right.
And they brought their daughter, and she's probably blushing now just because we're talking about her.
Yeah.
Because she pulled her hoodie down over her face. Don't talk about me.
Yeah, like Kenny from South Park. She just tied it real tight around her face as soon as we pointed her out.
Sorry.
We're excited.
We're going to call you out. Yeah, so that was fun. Good stuff for the 45th anniversary of Dawn of the Dead, which is still making its way around. I mean, I've seen people around the country posting about seeing that. By all means, go.
Oh, yeah, go. It's really a gorgeous print.
It's a gorgeous print and a lot of fun. So thank you for that. Look forward to next month or this month. I don't know. Yeah, coming soon. We'll talk about it later, the next Fright Club Live. The point is, today we're talking about art in horror movies and a great special guest.
We do. We're very excited. So recently I read the dark novella Muse, which I loved and literally read in its entirety as soon as I started it. Luckily, it's not super duper long, but I did neglect my work that day until I finished this book. I absolutely loved it. And LCW Allingham, the author, has happily, I'm so happy to say, joined us today for the podcast.
Yay, welcome.
Hey, guys. I'm so happy to be here. It's so nice to meet you, George. And Hope,
and you too.
It's great to put a face to the writing.
Let's talk a little bit about the novella. Tell us what you, because I'm afraid to talk about it because I don't want to give any spoilers away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier if we build off of what you say.
Right.
So the short version is that it's a novella about art, exploitation, and the dark primal magic of inspiration.
Ooh, I like that.
I have honestly had quite a hard time describing it in general myself. But, you know, it gets into artists, what moves them to create, and the people that feed off of that genius or creation.
Mm-hmm.
It's really one of the things that I thought was the most amazing about it is how vividly you describe some of the art. Particularly, it's not as if you're describing, you know, the Mona Lisa or an existing piece of art that we've all seen 100 times. You're making up a piece of art in your head and describing it in a way that I feel like I can really see it. I was so amazed by that.
Thank you. You know, that's actually funny because my mother was an artist.
Mm.
So I spent most of my life telling her what I thought of her pieces, because she was the kind of artist that she painted a ton. She was very prolific. So I was constantly being brought into her studio and asked, what do you think of this? So it's fortunate for this story, or maybe it's even why I wrote this story, because I got very good at describing art, even when I didn't necessarily like the piece, you know. And then I found that for artists, a lot of the times, it's not about like the colors or the shapes. It's about the emotion that it evokes. So I'm glad that that came across in the story because I wasn't sure if I got it. She was not always satisfied with my description of her work.
When we were first talking about doing this podcast together, you had mentioned that even though it's not going to make the list because it's dance, we did do a podcast on dance once, but that Suspiria, the original Suspiria, was in certain ways an inspiration for you as you wrote this book.
It was actually the 2018 Suspiria.
Nice. The Guadagnino, but nice.
The original one, I think, plays in as well because either way you have the idea of feeding off the artists in one way or another. And in that case, it was the dancers, but yeah.
I think that's a theme that comes up a lot anytime, art versus commerce.
Oh, yeah.
And what it maybe takes out of an artist or the sacrifices and how you cross or you walk that line is always fascinating. It comes up in a lot of works.
It does. It comes up in a lot of horror movies, for sure.
For sure.
Well, right. So we did, we landed on Fuzzy Math, a top five, but I want to run through a handful of the movies that I thought about, but we're not going to talk about. So one, Peter Strickland's Flux Gourmet.
Weird.
Which, yeah, that's about creating art through food and is a really super, as are all of his movies, beautifully bizarre. Also, Jeremy Saulnier's Murder Party, which is about a bunch of art majors who have a party to murder someone. Yep. And he shows up dressed as a knight in shining armor and is absolutely adorable.
Yeah, I love it.
That's a really fun movie. Midnight Meat Train, Kitamura's adaptation of a Clive Barker short with, of course, Bradley Cooper. We mentioned this one because he gets nominated for Oscars every year. And so we always talk about it with our Oscar podcast.
That is my husband's favorite and least favorite horror movie. He just scares the heck out of him.
Wow. All right.
You know, I think for me, the best parts of that movie are the subway, the when they're on the train. I'm not sure the whole art scene part of it stands up very well, although I do love Brooke Shields. Brooke Shields plays that sort of, you know, parasitic art dealer, and it was just funny to see her in something. But that was, I do enjoy that movie. Driller Killer, the Abel Ferrara classic.
Yes.
Classic in quotes. I do like that movie, but I don't know that I would actually call it a classic. Shudder, the original Shudder. Mm-hmm. That's a great movie. Super creepy. Very effective. That was very close to making this list. Joe Bego's Bliss.
You know, that's actually, when you brought up this topic, that's the first movie that popped into my head. Mm-hmm. Bliss.
I do like that movie. It's got this great frenetic energy. It feels borrowed from the movies that we are going to talk about, which is one of the reasons that it didn't make it. And then also Dan Gilroy's Velvet Buzzsaw, which also feels kind of borrowed from a lot of the movies that we have on this list. And I enjoyed. He teamed up again with Jake Gyllenhaal after their masterpiece, Nightcrawler.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think maybe just by comparison, it felt like a little bit of a disappointment, but it is a pretty fun movie.
Yeah, so those are runners-up. And also, this is where I have to give a shout-out to longtime Fright Clubbers know, the thing that scared me the most as a kid, not a movie, but an episode of Night Gallery, which, of course, was all about art every time, but the episode called The Cemetery with Roddy McDowall and Ossie Davis, and it's based around paintings. The paintings keep moving. They show the figure coming in out of the cemetery, and then there's a knock on the door, and oh my God, my 9-year-old self went nuts. So I had to get a shout out for that.
Yeah, but the whole series.
Oh yeah, love Night Gallery.
But and it's all about how creepy art can be.
I know, and a lot of those paintings were creepy.
They were.
Even if the episodes themselves didn't follow up on the potential, man, when he showed those paintings, and of course Rod Serling's voice, you're creeped out. And the beginning of the series, well, I'm getting off on a tangent.
Ohio and Rod Serling, by
the
way. Yeah.
Yes, good stuff. But anyway, so that's the ones before we get to the fuzzy math of our top six, top five.
And so we're going to start with number six.
Yes, number six is from 2015. A struggling painter is possessed by dark forces after he and his young family move into their dream home in rural Texas in this creepy haunted house tale called The Devil's Candy.
It's like it flowed through me. I don't remember painting this.
This is Mommy and Daddy's house. They're dead.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
I need to come home now.
We are his pawns. We are his demons on Earth. He uses us to carry out his unspeakable deeds. We satiate his hunger.
Your latest work is
wonderfully disturbing.
Oh my God.
I didn't mean to do this.
To sacrifice.
He will slither into your soul.
He's right. You are the sweetest candy of them all.
I'll be perfectly honest. This is not that great of a movie. I like it. It's a good movie. It's wildly borrowed. Not really from art movies as much as from, you know, they move into this house out in the sticks that's so cheap. Why is it cheap? For the same reason that all houses in horror movies are cheap. It's what? For the exact same reason.
You love it because it's directed by the same guy that did The Loved Ones.
That's exactly why.
That's why.
That's exactly why. Because, yeah, Sean Byrne, this was his very tardy follow-up to The Loved Ones, which, as anybody who is familiar with the podcast knows, is one of my all-time favorite movies. And I wanted so much to love this movie. And I do like it. And what I like the most about it, there are a couple of things. Ethan Embry is really, really good as the lead. He's a painter and a massive metalhead.
Mm-hmm.
And then also Pruitt Taylor Vince. Rubberhead, he grew up in the house. He murdered his family in this house, and he keeps sort of haunting the house, but he lives in a motel nearby. So he keeps making friends with Ethan Embry's preteen daughter. One of the things, and I do think that they generate a lot of tension with that, with this serial killer, child killer theme. I actually think that the art side of the film is a bit of a distraction, or vice versa. I feel like it's two separate movies. But what I like about the art side of the film are two things. The actual art that Ethan Embry creates once he sort of is possessed by the house.
Mm-hmm. That painting was so super creepy.
Right? It's very, very creepy. It's very effective. And also, very rarely, I think, we did a whole podcast once on rock music, and I think very rarely does a filmmaker make do as good a job of running with the music that he's chosen for a film as this one does. That he does such a great job of just weaving hard rock throughout this movie and making it really a character in the film. And I do love that as well.
Well, going back to the actual artwork, Sean Byrne says the artwork in the film was painted by Stephen Kasner, quote, a wonderful artist and a member of the Church of Satan.
Oh, I see.
Byrne wanted to get, he says he wanted to get as close to the source as we could. Hey now.
There's a scene in that movie. It's toward the end, and I don't want to give anything away. But it seems like it's almost the culmination of the entire movie where you have guitar smashing, fire, and murder all in one. And I honestly felt watching that movie that the whole movie came from that one scene. The entire premise was that scene that grew into a movie. And what I really liked about that movie is it felt like Ethan Embry's character was Mark, his character from Empire Records, grown up.
Oh, oh yeah. And how
that.
Sad. I hoped that gave me quite
an appreciation for the movie that I might not have had if they'd cast anybody else in that role.
Yeah, he is really wonderful in that film. And so much of it, you know, his big eyes. He always just seems so human no matter what his character is like. We also love him in That Thing You Do.
Oh, yeah. And this is the first one where he was all jacked up.
Oh, yeah,
all of a sudden, right, which really fits the character and the frenzy and the intensity of the whole thing.
And there's something really, really powerful about that. The image of him with that mask on and the spray paint can out ahead of him with this, you know, this throbbing music behind him. I mean, there's a lot that's done well about this film. I do feel like it's a little disjointed, but it is
heavy
creepy.
And well done image heavy film. And I think the images are what carried that film.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and yeah, always love to see Pruitt Taylor Vince. And whoever, if you didn't catch that Rubberhead reference, it's because he played a character named Rubberhead in the Paul Newman movie Nobody's Fool. So every time we see him, we call him, hey, Rubberhead. So that's that reference, just to bring you up to speed. Okay, Devil's Candy from 2015, number six. Let's do a classic at number five from 1953. An associate burns down a wax museum with the owner inside, but he survives only to become vengeful and murderous. House of Wax.
The House of Wax, the ultimate dimension in terror, comes to the screen in Stereo Vision 3D. Vincent Price at his diabolical best will take you room by terrible room on a journey to the ultimate chamber of horrors. StereoVision 3D will synthesize before your eyes the terrifying reality of it all. In StereoVision 3D, House of Wax.
So this is Vincent Price starring in a remake of the 1933 film Mystery of the Wax Museum. And this movie has Vincent Price written all over it. There are any number of films in his canon where he plays a man who is disfigured in some accident and becomes sort of maniacal and vengeful. And he's really exceptional in that role, no matter the film. But he's great in this one because we get more of him pre-disfigurement than we do in most of the films like that. And he's just so elegant and pompous about his art, about being an artist. And I think it's in that part of the film that we get the best look at the conflict between art and commerce. And there are a lot of other films since this. Obviously, there was a remake of this film, I think, in 2005. But also one of my favorite movies from the 80s, Waxworks, which is, in many ways, you know, it takes a certain set, because his wax figures are all based on real, like, executions and sort of crime scenes. And I think Waxworks took that and ran with it as well, which was really fun in that movie. But I do love a lot about this movie, primarily Vincent Price, secondarily Carolyn Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Who's so funny and adorable in this movie as sort of this, you know, this young tart that is just goofy and silly and winds up as one of the wax figures. And so, and her roommate, who is the lead of the film, realizes that it's her, and that's what starts the mystery sort of unfolding about what's going on. And then also, I love that Charles Bronson is in this movie.
I know.
I remember the first time I saw this movie,
early
I was like,
Charles Bronson.
I know. I was like, is that Charles Bronson? Is like Igor, a mute Igor. Yeah. There's
well,
so
he's
many...
got a face that you just, that's got to be Charles
oh,
Bronson.
Oh, yeah, clearly. That's clearly Charles Bronson. I do think that this movie is, I mean, you if you watch it now, you've clearly seen countless other films that have been patterned on at least parts of this movie. So it feels campy and familiar, but it's for me, it stands up really well.
It's also one of the first major studio films shot in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that it's only about nine or less than 90 minutes long, but when it first came out, it had an intermission because the studio thought the 3D would be too intense for people. They just need to take a breath, walk it off. Intermission for a 90-minute film.
Yeah.
And it fits sort of like art imitating life, because Vincent Price, actually, he was a connoisseur of fine art, and he donated some of his collection to East Los Angeles College, and they have an art museum there named for him.
Does he haunt it?
We hope so.
I do hope so.
We hope so. That would be best. I like this one. I watched a bit of it. I always have a little bit of trouble with the 50s movies in the sense that there's gaslighting of the ingenues is so heavy. I mean, she literally saw her best friend get murdered. She saw her body got stolen. She was chased by the killer. And then when she's like, I know exactly what's happening, they're like, girl, you're crazy.
Yeah.
It is really
But otherwise,
annoying.
You got to look at the culture of the time and be like, okay, as long as we can put a pin in that and recognize what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. That's true.
For sure. And that's probably one of the more famous Vincent Price films at number five, House of Wax from 1953. Let's stay in the 50s for Roger Corman. Always fun. This is at number four. A dim-witted busboy at a beatnik cafe passes off a cat he accidentally killed and covered in plaster as a sculpture, prompting a demand for more art that compels him to commit murders. It's a bucket of blood.
Come, enjoy yourself. Where the hilarious enjoy the horrifying. In a bucket of blood.
Now you're gonna shoot me, don't shoot!
Come to the land of living dreams, where realists dream of the unreal.
Walter, you've done something to me. Something deep down inside of my prana. Oh, Walter, I want to be with you. You're creative.
Beatniks at their bawdiest. The creative urge at its most primitive.
For I'm deeply moved. And I shall compose a poem.
Love is art. Art is love. It's the weirdest and the wildest.
I don't want to make statues anymore. I want to get married. To you.
Well, Well, the first thing I like about this movie is Dick Miller.
Yeah.
Dick Miller, if you don't know his name, he was, man, he's a that guy from way back. And a lot of people probably only saw him as an older man. And in this one, it's that guy, and he's young.
Yep.
I love that. And also, there's a Burt Convy sighting. Right? Burt Convy, the game show host from the 70s. Burt Convy's in this movie.
This is an early Roger Corman. It's written by Charles B. Griffith, who also wrote Little Shop of Horrors, mm-hmm. which is, by all rights, a superior film to this. But this is this movie, A Bucket of Blood, is also one of those movies that is exclusively a riff on House of Wax. But in a beatnik, you know, yeah. and also as a comedy, as an outright comedy that sort of pokes fun at the beatnik culture. It's absolutely it's kind of riddled with issues of not just this time period, but just of Roger Corman films. Mm-hmm. The way that the women are presented in the movie and sort of I loved that the hostess, you know, rejects the janitor turned, the Dick Miller character, because he's doing all this eventually. He thinks that he's going to get to date the hostess at this sort of beatnik coffee house where they're showing art, because she really has an interest in his art. She's interested in what he's doing. So he naturally thinks that means that she likes him, and she turns him down, and I appreciated that. But then she immediately agrees to pose nude for him. And I thought, only a man would have written that. Like, there is zero chance of
Roger
woman.
Roger Corman.
Yeah, no. Yes, no, I don't want to date you, but I'll be nude alone with you when all of your sculpture is about murder. Absolutely, why not? That's a pretty big sticking point in this movie. But Dick Miller is a selling point, you know, because even though I think the character is written in an incredibly one-dimensional way, he's always referred to as this dim-witted janitor. He's really he humanizes that character to a degree that you sincerely feel badly for him, because he's so easily swayed one way or the other, and he doesn't have any deep thoughts about what's going on, which is simultaneously troubling. And there's a complexity there that makes the movie, I think, more interesting than it is sort of on paper.
Mm-hmm. And Dick Miller made, oh my Lord, probably hundreds of movies, but this is one of only three where he was the lead.
Oh, yeah.
On just two others. And after this, in four other movies, he played the same character, Walter Paisley, including Chopping Mall,
yeah.
which we just got done talking about.
Yep.
It just kept going up, but going back to this character name. And also, see if you agree with this, even though this is a comedy, it's a lot of times pointed to one of the first slasher movies, even though it's a comedy treatment.
Hmm. Hmm.
That pass your...
No.
Okay.
Not really, but I might have a specific definition of slasher. What did you think about this one?
This is one that I actually didn't get a chance to watch, so I'm not familiar with this one at all, but it's on my list.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, for sure, you'll have some issues with the way women are presented, but
yeah.
I mean, you know, no matter how much I
always do.
Yeah, but no matter how much I love the films that came out of Roger Corman's sort of, you know, stable, whether he directed them or not, the way the women are presented is almost always clearly written by a man. I mean, and they 100% of the time they were written by men. I don't think he ever worked with a female writer, and that's absolutely the case here. But if you see it as a comedy, mm-hmm. and a very low budget. comedy. A lot of that can be forgiven, but not entirely.
And that's A Bucket of Blood from 1959 at number four. So let's go out of the 50s and up to this year. Very recent film at number three. A stop-motion animator struggles to control her demons after the loss of her overbearing mother. It's called Stop Motion.
I don't want to make this film anymore.
Don't you want to hear the next bit of the story?
I want to go.
I want to go.
What happens when it takes on a life of its own?
Again, this is a really visually heavy film. In fact, maybe more so than Devil's Candy. I really enjoyed it, but I did feel like there was a little bit of story lacking in this one. The visuals were absolutely horrific, especially as it goes on. It gets scarier and scarier and scarier. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to have nightmares about it for the rest of my life, just from how it looked alone. But I always prefer story over anything else, obviously being a novelist and a writer. So I found myself wanting a little bit more from it when it was over.
Mm. I do think one of the things I like about this film, aside from the visuals, which are really disturbing, is she's a stop motion animator, and she's found her muse is this little girl. And I think one of the things I like about it is you think you know who the little girl is early on, and you're not necessarily wrong, but why she's there, I think the filmmaker, it's Robert Morgan, who has done primarily short, I think exclusively shorts up to now, he sows the seeds of having you believe you know what kind of trauma this artist, who's played by Aisling Franciosi from Nightingale, from Jennifer Kent's Nightingale.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes. And you think you feel like, you know, this is why this is happening. This is what this is all about. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it's not about what you maybe think it's about in the first place at all. It's really, and I think it does a better job than most films I've seen of doing this, it is really about the conflict of wanting to be an artist and recognizing that to survive, you are almost certainly going to have to sell your wares to some commercial soulless venture.
Art and commerce again, yeah.
Right. And I think art and commerce really is. It's the heart of the conflict in a lot of movies about art, horror movies, and particularly about art. But I think this one animates it. See how I did that? Better than most. And she, the lead character, one of the things is she's not ever at any point of the film is she particularly likable, which is my favorite thing in a female lead in a movie, is for you're not expected to like her, but you're still compelled by her story. That's awesome. And I love a lot of the decisions that she makes, and they're never dumb. They're often hard to understand, but she never just does a dumb thing because it benefits the overall story if she just does this one dumb thing. She makes consistently bizarre choices that in the end make sense if considering sort of where her mind is at. And I appreciate that as well. It's definitely in terms of, as you were saying, as of a story, it's not detailed in the scripting, right? Mm-hmm. You're really just sort of following along her descent into madness without a great deal.
Character study.
Yeah, not a lot of structure available there. But there are certain scenes in this movie. There's one where her boyfriend's sister gives her some Molly to take at a party. And the way that whole scene transpires, I just thought was inspired, especially the last moment of that scene. And also the art itself is so disturbing. Mm-hmm. And there's this Ashman character. And again, you're quite sure through the film, you know what this character represents. And I love that you're wrong. I love that. So I was really impressed by this one.
And for anybody that didn't know, I didn't, using real meat for stop motion is an actual technique. Stop motion legend named Jan Svankmajer uses real meat for stop motion. So look him up. I like the poster for this movie, which we should do that sometime. Posters. We haven't done posters.
We haven't done posters.
So the movie doesn't have to be good, just the poster.
Right.
But that's a good one for stop motion. Number 3 from this year. So is it streaming?
It is, yes.
Great, so check it out.
Yes, it is.
If you haven't already. Stop motion at number 3. So moving up to number 2, a favorite from just a few years ago. This is The Enchanted Lives of a Couple in a Secluded Forest, brutally shattered by a nightmarish hippie cult and their demon biker henchmen, propelling a man into a spiraling, surreal rampage of vengeance. Nick Cage and Mandy.
So what are you going to do with that?
I'm going hunting.
So what you hunting?
It's crazy evil.
Oh, man. They robbed you. Ah! Ah! You exceed the cosmic darkness.
It glowed from within. Strange and eternal.
So I have have to say, I really love that Nick Cage is embracing horror a lot more recently. Mm-hmm. I think he really belongs there. He does it so well because he doesn't hold back at all. And this is one of those films where he just shines in all kinds of crazy psychedelic mm-hmm. colors. Mm-hmm. It took me a little while to figure out what I even thought of Mandy because it's that crazy of a film. It's just an absolute rampage odyssey, a psychedelic trip, like from beginning to end, and it doesn't stop. And everything about it is art. So it's one of those films you're never going to forget once you watch it. And it's not necessarily a good thing, but it is what it is. I, for one, though, have landed on loving it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We love this one.
I love it. It's just it's such an experience. I know the term fever dream is thrown around a lot, but that's what it feels like. And of course, when you talk about art, when this movie, how you perceive this movie can really hinge on art.
Yeah.
Without giving away too much. But I know we've discussed that the certain artwork in this movie and what it means to the story. I'm trying to tiptoe around this.
Well,
but it's very important.
We were talking about this actually with Monty at the end of the last Fright Club Live. So I'll just say for anybody who is worried, this could potentially be a spoiler. So spoiler alert coming. There, you can absolutely read this film as so. Red Miller is Nick Cage's character, and he lives with his beloved Mandy, who is played by Andrea Riseborough. And she's a painter and a novelist. And when you look early on at her art, it all kind of almost looks like Ronnie James Dio album covers. Like, that's the sort of tone and theme. And you can absolutely see the entire film at the end as being one of her paintings.
Yep.
Like, the story that is behind a painting that she's painting, as opposed to being real life. And I think that's why. Because originally I hadn't planned on putting this in this list. It was actually your idea that it belong in the list. And so I rethought that, and it's actually very high on the list, because as long as that's your read of it, it makes perfect sense to fit here. It is how I see it. That's how I
– Me too.
Right.
How I see the film. And in doing that, it makes the wild ride seem more logical because it's this bizarre adventure tale that this woman is writing. Also, though, I think that, it is so nuts where the story goes. There are cannibal bikers, cannibal demon bikers. There's
Bill Duke.
Yeah. There's Bill Duke, the chemist, which is played by Richard Brake, who is always great and creepy and everything. And in this one, which is always so fun, when you see Richard Brake's face in anything, you're like, uh-oh. But in this one, he's not really a bad guy. He kind of is, if you think about what he does for a living. But, I mean, he doesn't mean Red any harm. And then Jeremiah Sand plays Lytus Roach, who is like the leader of the cult. And the rest of the cult has got some great, Olwen Forey and Ned Dennehy. So some great character actors. Top to bottom, the cast in this movie is just remarkable. And then Panos Cosmatos, who made the movie, he made a movie a few years before that called Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is set at the exact same time period. They're both set in 1983. They're both such exquisite examples of that time period, and they're so wildly, wildly mm-hmm. different, because Black Rainbow is very antiseptic and, and tidy. It's got more like sort of, new wave kind of vibe mm-hmm. about it, and this one has that sort of very Dio kind of vibe. I just love that. I love that he set two films in the same year, and they could be so insanely different and still so evocative of their time period.
You know, and I agree with you about the theory about Mandy's art. And while I don't think it is forced,
no.
I also don't think it's that hidden either. I mean, when we talked to Monty about it, he made it seem like other people he talked to were like, that's crazy. I don't think it's crazy at all.
No, especially the very, very ending images of the movie, I think, certainly embolden that theory.
Yeah, for sure. And
right,
I know
that makes sense.
It's a favorite.
That's not one I knew, but I like that. I like that idea. It makes me like the film even more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of Nick Cage in horror, his latest is Arcadian, which is it's a creature feature where he dials it way down, way down.
Oh, wow.
And he's understated. So because he's the father of a twin boys trying to get through this dystopian creature feature future. But you're right, though. He's embracing it.
I think
I have to put that on my list.
One of the funny things about Mandy is that the movie is so nuts that even a completely unhinged Nick Cage doesn't outshine
right.
the insanity
no,
of the film
he belongs
around him.
Completely in that movie.
Exactly right. Yeah, and that's a favorite. That's Mandy from 2018. Number two. So what could beat it for art in horror? Well, one from 2021, a sequel to the horror film Candyman from 92 that returns to the now gentrified Chicago neighborhood where the legend began. 2022, Nia DaCosta's Candyman.
I think I made a mistake. I brought him back.
Candyman isn't real!
Something's happening to me.
He had a purpose for you. Be another one of his terrible stories.
I guess he found me. I am the writing on the wall. The sweet smell of blood. Be my victim.
This is not real. It's not real.
Candyman.
Well, even talking about art and horror, even if this movie was terrible, which it most certainly is not, just the shadow cutouts alone.
Oh my God.
Qualify. Because remember when they first released that trailer with the shadow? I was like, holy crap, that's beautiful.
It was. Yeah, it is absolutely beautiful.
And I love the movie.
And then at the end of the film, when they bring it back and you see everything that DaCosta and co-writer Jordan Peele planned to do with that, like planned to explain with those paper cuts, really it was in no way just sort of flashy. It was really integral to the point that they were trying to make with the movie.
Loved it.
I love this movie. I love the original, of course. This is a direct sequel to the original Candyman, and it's set in the gentrified Cabrini Green, and which is now part of a booming art district where the lead character, who is played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, his girlfriend Tiona Paris, played by Tiona Paris, she works sort of as an agent inside this art world, and he is an artist inside this art world. And one of the things that I think works really well about the film is not just the art itself, which does work really well, but the way that they set the whole film inside the art world, I think, works really well. And also DaCosta's shot making. Every single scene is a piece of art itself. I mean, I loved the way she reflected the world in the way that she was shooting. The underneath story, say his name, it had so much to do with Black Lives Matter and violence against Black population, particularly by the police, but really by everybody, and how, it could be turned into a legend. There were underlying themes that I think were much larger than the art world itself, obviously, but in terms of this countdown, the way that she represented the art world in this movie, I thought was just spectacular.
Yeah, it was. You also get the great Coleman Domingo.
Oh, yeah.
Vanessa Williams, who apparently does not age a
day.
Yes,
I know.
She looks exactly the same from the first one, and she is great. And you're right about the art represented in this movie. And also, I just thought it was so good, it made you totally think about the original in a different way.
Yes.
Which I just thought was great.
Yeah, I agree. This felt like, it definitely felt like a sequel instead of like some movies that they'll do after so many years. It feels like they're kind of just tacking it together to make something and capitalize on something that was successful before. But this feels like the natural evolution of what happened to all of these characters. It felt very organic and continued the terrifying story that was there. I always find the Candyman stories to just be so incredibly sad.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they all stand on their own. And this one, again, had the same kind of sad arcs, and really it had a lot of the same tragic themes while also telling us something new about it.
Right.
And making it relevant to the modern day and modern day problems.
Exactly. And it also found a very fitting and organic way to give us Tony Todd, which we wanted.
Yes.
We wanted, but not just a,
not a cameo.
Not a throwaway. Yeah. It meant something.
Yeah, it did. And also, and another Clive Barker short story
that's right.
Yeah, that evolved into, and as a writer, his His material is so visual. You feel like you can see, which yes. is sometimes, you know, considering what he writes, worse, because I'm not sure I want those images in my head. But but this is, you know, I loved everything. I loved the way they tied this film to the original.
Yeah.
And I love the way they pulled all of the themes together so beautifully as they moved all the way through the film. And I did love Coleman Domingo in this movie.
Yeah.
God,
always.
That guy has range.
Always. Always. Mm-hmm. Candyman from 2021, number one on our list of art in horror. That's a good list and a good conversation. Thank you so much for coming on and joining us. And I want to talk a little bit more before we go about your project, your book, and where we can all find you.
So Muse is available pretty much anywhere you can buy books online. You can also go to the publisher's website, so it's just specpub.com, and find all of the links there. And Spec Pub is going to be putting out more horror. And if you have not read it, you must pick up a copy of Incubate and read Hope's Story Aggrieved, which is absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
Yay.
Yeah, Speculation Publications. So tell us a little bit about that, because that is, you know, it is such a great indie horror publisher.
We're working our way up. We have about 7 titles now. We were going to put out our biggest collection yet this fall. It's Grimm Retold, and it's a collection of horror retelling of Grimm fairy tales. We have some amazing stories selected for already. We're still finishing the final touches, so I can't tell you too much about it. But it's gonna kill. And we also will be releasing another novella. We have not announced it yet, but it's going to be coming out probably sometime early next year. And we are always looking for new horror and all that stuff. Just go to our submission page and see when things are being called for.
Yay!
Nice. We are looking forward to our next Fright Club Live, May 10th.
Yeah, speaking of Nick Cage.
Yes, speaking of Nick Cage, we got something for you. All Nick Cage all the time in horror.
That's right. We're going to show the movie Mom and Dad, which is a really fun, twisty, weird. And it's a great performance from Nick Cage. And we are going to run down the 5 best Nick Cage horror films.
Just 5.
I know.
Narrow it down to 5.
I know. It's actually. It's already, my short list is already 12.
Whoa.
That's going to be hard.
Be some pruning.
It is hard.
Maybe some fuzzy math. Okay, that is May 10th. We'll be back at Gateway Film Center. As always, we'll start with a little happy hour. Then we record the podcast at 9, and we see the film at 9:30.
We're going to show the short film Tied Down by Jasper Jones.
Right.
Jasper
Love
Jones,
that.
Short film Tied Down. And then we also want to point out that that the series Femme Fatality is still going on every Wednesday, 8 o'clock, Gateway Film Center, until the middle of June, where we show a horror film directed by a woman, as well as a short film directed by a woman, sometimes the same woman, sometimes a different woman, depending. This coming Wednesday is going to be Tigers Are Not Afraid.
Oh,
I'm super excited about that one. And also, if you haven't heard, they're going to show Obstacle Corpse on Wednesday, May 22nd. And we're going to premiere our brand new short horror called Basement Buddy.
Yeah, that is going to be fun. So hope to see you at any or all of those at Gateway Film Center, our home away from home. In the meantime, you can always find us. Madwolf.com is the main website. Also, Fright Club Live now we've got on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Fright Club Pod on the X. And we've got the dedicated Fright Club Podcast Facebook group. If you want to join, just find that and do the old request, and we'll get you in there. A lot of fun stuff about horror movies and funny stuff, too. We just have a good time with horror fans in there. And did I miss one? Did I miss any?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think that's everything.
So keep in touch if you can. We'd love to hear from you. Keep talking the horror movies. Thank you so much. Thank you so much,
yeah.
LCW Allingham.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Loved your insight and your love of Nick Cage. and art and horror. And pick up her book. Pick up Hope's book. And we'll talk to you soon. So until next time, she is Hope Madden.
He's George Wolf.
And this is the Fright Club Podcast.
I'm LC Allingham. Stay frightful, my friends.